Our words for prayer or meditation this morning come from a book of meditations by Meg Barnhouse. Meg Barnhouse is a UU minister. She has a couple books of meditations published by Skinner House Press, which is one of the Unitarian Universalist presses that publishes little meditation manuals. And a lot of hers are very funny and witty, which is not a word I usually associate with meditations, but yet they are. This one is not so much funny, but I found it very meaningful and fit with what I wanted to say today. So here are Meg Barnhouse's words, brick by brick. All summer, workers have been building a brick wall along the road by my neighborhood. Against the brutal heat, they stretch a tarp overhead to get a little shade. I've watched them take bricks in their dusty brown hands one by one, butter them thickly with mortar, line them up, and tap them down, row by row. One man who looks to be in his 70s is the leader. His skin is the color of bittersweet chocolate. His beard is gray. Slender and tall, he moves from one group of bricklayers to the next, reaching and bending, looking like a heron in the marsh. When he pauses, he stands very straight. I see him teach the others how to do the work. He stoops over to look at a line of bricks, hands on his thighs, inspecting the work. Sometimes as I drive by, I see him put his hand on the back of the person he's teaching. Often they are both smiling. He looks like he loves what he's doing. I wonder, how can he love building walls day by day, handling bricks, teaching the art of laying bricks? Is it the teaching he loves? Seeing how his students learn, what their styles are, how the work shows their character. Does he love the wall itself? Does he know about when it'll be done? Does he look forward to seeing it finished? Or does he love the process, the feel of the bricks in his hands, the squish of the mortar, the challenge of making the symmetry of pillars and arches, the geometry of it? I think, from the look on his face, that he loves the process. I imagine that he never thinks about the end of the project, the completion of the wall. I think he will go on to the next wall as if it were just a continuation of this one, then the next one, and the next, and never be bored. I want to be like that. And I am, I guess. In my job as a minister, the bricks are stories. I hear stories of family and work, stories of loss and reconciliation, stories of rejection and disaster, illness and healing, birthing and dying. I tell stories every Sunday and in between, teaching, challenging, confessing, inviting people to learn and laugh and think. Brick by brick, story by story, we build a church. Seeing the patterns, the symmetry, the plain joy of setting one story on the other, sustained by the strong and beautiful structures they make. We will never be finished. It's okay. So, in the process of becoming a Unitarian Universalist minister, after you have done most of your seminary and your internship and you've gone through psychological testing and you've done a chaplaincy in a hospital or other setting and you've been interviewed by a number of people who've written letters of recommendation and you've completed all your paperwork, then you go before the Ministerial Fellowship Committee. And the MFC, as they're called, has the ultimate decision about whether or not you're suited to be a Unitarian Universalist minister. And so they, before the MFC, which is a panel of, I don't know, 8 or 10 people, you preach a 10-minute sermon, no shorter, no longer, 10 minutes, and then they grill you on everything under the sun, theology, history, polity, social justice, religious education, pastoral care, world religions, you name it. And when I went before the MFC, there was a moment when I finally knew I was doing okay here. And it was a moment where I made them laugh. So they were giving me a list of people and saying, we're going to list off people, you tell us what they're famous for. and Unitarian Universalist figures, basically. We'll tell, list them off. You tell them me why they're famous. So they listed off some people like Emerson, and then they got to Jared Sparks. And I said, he was ordained. And they laughed. This was a joke. Not a very funny one, as you see. None of you got it. But this is what passes for humor in the Unitarian Universalist ministry, you see. But by the end of the sermon, you'll get this joke. So Jared Sparks was not famous. And that's why it's kind of funny, because they asked, why is he famous? I said, well, he was ordained. And he wasn't famous in and of himself, but at his ordination, William Ellery Channing preached a very important and influential sermon. This was actually Channing's sermon at his ordination that's famous, and that's the joke. So they laughed, and they said, okay, obviously you know, but please tell us why that's important that he was ordained, and I did, and we moved on. William Ellery Channing is an important and historical figure in Unitarian history. And perhaps he's like the most important figure in Unitarian history. And yet he is seldom preached on, not that often referenced. There's no real modern biography written of him. Jack Mendelsohn's 1971 biography is out of print. And so my resources today come from mostly encyclopedic entries on him, Encyclopedia Britannica, Wikipedia, the Harvard Square Library, the Dictionary of UU Biographies, and a paper on William Ellery Channing and Slavery by Robert Michael Rule, published by Starr King School for the Ministry, and two other sermons by Rachel Tedesco and J. Frank Schulman, plus excerpts from various UU history books and other history books. So if we don't talk about him much, why am I talking about him now? Well, this spring, May 5th to be exact, is the 200th anniversary of that very important sermon, of William Ellery Channing's most important sermon, which is arguably the most important sermon given in the history of Unitarianism, and perhaps one of the most important sermons given in America ever. I can't preach about it on May 5th because that's going to be a very busy day here at FPC. Yeah, as some of you know, that's the day of my installation in the afternoon, and Susan Frederick Gray, our UUA president, is going to be here, and you're all invited. And in the morning, it's going to be our Youth Sunday, so the youth will be leading the service. So May 5th is not a great day to preach on that 200th anniversary of the Baltimore Sermon, but today is actually William Ellery Channing's birthday, so I thought it would be another good day to talk about him. So let me tell you a little bit more about him as I build up to that very important sermon. William Ellery Channing was born on April 7th, 1780, in Newport, Rhode Island. He was the grandson of William Ellery, named for him, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. His family was wealthy and influential. They attended the Second Congregational Church, where the minister was Ezra Stiles. Now here's a little detour. Ezra Stiles' grandson was the Unitarian minister Ezra Stiles Gannett, who would become William Ellery Channing's associate minister much later. His son was William Channing Gannett, named for William Ellery Channing, and is the author of our opening and closing hymns today. Thus ends the sidebar about the Stiles and Gannett family. So there were several preachers who were influential to William Ellery Channing in his youth, one of whom was his uncle, Henry Channing, who he was sent to study with. And he entered, after studying with William, with Henry Channing, he entered Harvard at age 15. Now, while Channing was at Harvard, the French Revolution was underway. He wrote of that time, "College was never in a worse state than when I entered it." Can you imagine that? College was never worse than then. Society was passing through a most critical stage. The French Revolution had diseased the imagination and unsettled the understanding of men everywhere. The old foundations of social order, loyalty, tradition, habit, reverence for antiquity were everywhere shaken, if not subverted. The authority of the past was gone. Such a tumultuous age that Channing is coming forward in. And he was the top student at Harvard and was therefore the valedictorian speaker, but the faculty prohibited him from speaking on the revolution or on other political issues in his address. At first, Channing refused to speak, but then he came to some sort of understanding with the president and agreed to speak. Frank Shulman writes this. He was forbidden to make any reference to politics, but that didn't deter young Channing. He railed against the French and, in closing, turned on the faculty. Facing them squarely, he stormed, "But that I am forbid, I could a tale enfold which would harrow up your souls." And with that declaration, to the applause of his listeners, he concluded his college career. Following college, Channing took a job as a tutor for a family in Virginia. It was not a good time for him. It took a toll on his health, and while he had encountered slavery in Rhode Island, and indeed had grown up with slaves, seeing slavery in the South left a huge negative impact on him. Robert Michael Rule writes, "Up to this time, there is little evidence to show Channing had thought much about the institution of slavery. In his memoirs, it is clear that his time in Richmond awakened him to the evils of slavery. He stated that the condition of master and slave was not natural and that slavery was degrading. These insights arose from visiting the slaves on his employer's plantation. He would take food to the slaves, sit and talk with the slaves. And once when his employer was gone, Channing was put in charge of them. Because of his experience," he wrote, "the influence of slavery on the whites is almost as fatal as on the blacks themselves." The experience and the toll on his health was enough to make Channing leave the South and state that because of slavery, he would never be able to live there again. But it would take much longer in his life before Channing was willing to take a real public stand against slavery that he would later be known for. Channing returned to New England and to a position at Harvard, where he studied some more with the professor David Tappan, and he became licensed to preach and then was called to and ordained by the Federal Street Church in Boston, which is now the Arlington Street Church, in 1803. There he would serve as minister for the rest of his career. In 1805, the Unitarian controversy begins to erupt. David Tappan retired from that seat at Harvard, and Henry Ware was appointed to the endowed chair. Henry Ware was a Unitarian, and the conservative Trinitarians were angered by this appointment. By 3 years later, in 1808, Andover Theology School was founded in response, as Harvard now seemed to be thoroughly and unrepentingly Unitarian, and Trinitarian ministers started to refuse to exchange pulpits with those deemed to be Unitarian. Now, the Unitarians were not claiming that label yet of Unitarian. It was a charge leveled against them, made by the more theologically conservative against the more theologically liberal within Congregationalism. Various articles and pamphlets were written back and forth by different ministers over the next decade. Then, in 1815, Jedediah Morse reprinted an article in his magazine accusing the Unitarians of being Unitarian, and Samuel Thatcher followed suit, claiming that Unitarians were afraid to claim that label. Channing was a senior minister now, having served for 13 years, and he wrote a response to Thatcher titled, "A Letter to the Reverend Samuel C. Thatcher on the Aspersions Contained in a Late Number of the Panoplist on the Ministers of Boston and the Vicinity, 1815. At this time, Channing is basically denying the Unitarian charge, saying about Harvard, for example, "The statement of the reviewer that the propagation of Unitarianism in that university is the object of regular and well-concerted exertion is altogether false." This letter basically made Channing the spokesperson for the liberal ministers as a prominent minister of the big church in Boston and as a well-established preacher. And so, in 1819, 200 years ago this May, Channing was invited to preach the ordination sermon at the ordination of the fellow named Jared Sparks in Baltimore. It was a new church with a new minister being installed there, and it was a groundbreaking moment. The sermon was an hour and a half long. Just remember that when I go over a little. And the acoustics were so bad that only the first three rows could hear what he had to say. But the sermon was immediately printed up and distributed and sold, and its initial print run of 2,000 immediately sold out, and it was reprinted many times. I think I read that it sold over 10,000 copies. In its pamphlet form, it sold more copies than any other American pamphlet that had ever been printed. I mean, that includes the one Alexander Hamilton wrote about his affair, folks. Never think that theology can't be juicy stuff. Very controversial. The sermon was titled Unitarian Christianity, and it was Unitarians claiming that title of Unitarianism for themselves for the first time. Channing used as his text for the sermon a passage from 1 Thessalonians. Prove all things, hold fast to that which is good. First, he argued, in proving all things, that one has to use reason when approaching the scriptures, that basically it's impossible to read the Bible, or any other book for that matter, without using reason. And it was meant to be used with reason. It was meant to be brought with our full minds to the exercise of. He then goes to talk about the importance of the unity of God, that God is one, and there is but one God. And then in his third section, he argues against the Trinity. Here are his words. We object to the doctrine of the Trinity that whilst acknowledging in words, it subverts in effect the unity of God. According to this doctrine, there are three infinite and equal persons possessing supreme divinity called the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Each of these persons, as described by theologians, has his own particular consciousness, will, and perceptions. They love each other, converse with each other, and delight in each other's society. They perform different parts in man's redemption, each having his appropriate office and neither doing the work of the other. The Son is the mediator and not the Father. The Father sends the Son and is not himself sent, nor is he conscious like the Son of having taken flesh. Here, then, we have three intelligent agents possessed of different consciousness, different wills, and different perceptions, performing different acts, sustaining different relations. And if these things do not imply and constitute three minds or beings, we are utterly at a loss to know how three minds or beings are to be formed. Basically, he's arguing the Trinity, three parts, one person of God, makes no sense to him. He then turns to Jesus and declares that Jesus is fully human, saying, we believe that Jesus is one mind, one soul, one being, one as truly one as we are, and equally distinct from the one God. Channing puts forward logical arguments, like that Jesus talks often about God, and never as if he's talking about himself when he does so. And is referred to as the Son of God, as sent by God, and not as if he himself is God. And after he makes these arguments, Channing then turns for the fourth section of his speech to the moral perfection of God, and then finally, in his final section, to what Jesus means for human morality. The Baltimore sermon, as the sermon was known, was a gauntlet thrown down. It was a declaration of Unitarianism that would reverberate throughout the established Congregational Church. Throughout New England and beyond, over the next decades, the churches began to split, with legal battles over which group would get the church building and the silver, and which group would have to move to a new building, often next door. Channing remained influential throughout all this. In 1816, he helped found Harvard Divinity School as a separate school within Harvard. A decade later, he would give the speech when they dedicated the Divinity Hall building, the oldest building now standing in Harvard Divinity School. In 1820, he and other colleagues founded the Berry Street Conference, which is America's longest-running lecture series, with a lecture being presented every year at the UU Ministry Days preceding the UUA General Assembly. The Berry Street Conference led to the creation of the American Unitarian Association in 1825, which Channing was also influential in founding, and refused to be the president of. If that weren't enough to have done, it was Channing's idea that led to the formation of the Transcendental Club, which brought together Emerson and Thoreau and Hawthorne and Alcott. Channing attended a few times, was something of an honorary Transcendentalist, but didn't attend often for fear that his presence as sort of the stately grandfather of the group would stifle conversation. His nephews, though, William Ellery Channing, called Ellery to distinguish him from his namesake, and William Henry Channing were prominent Transcendentalists. And Channing was revered by both the Transcendentalists and those they rebelled against, the more traditional Unitarians that were sometimes called Channing Unitarians. As if all that influence weren't enough, in 1830, he wrote Remarks on American Literature that helped define American literature as a separate and distinct thing from English literature, with its own traditions and importance. Frank Carpenter writes, in his lifetime and long after it, Channing was the most influential American religious leader whose works were known beyond America. His books, translated into many languages, traveled the world and were read attentively by Alexis de Tocqueville, Ernest Renan, Hajram Kisor Singh, John Stuart Mill, Max Weber, Krishna Janos, and Queen Victoria. It wasn't until relatively late in his life, in 1835, at the age of 65, that Channing published his book, Slavery. Because of his prominence, his words were given great weight, but he also received critique from all angles. For the abolitionists, it was too little, too late. For the Southerners, it was too abolitionist. Robert Michael Rule writes, William Lloyd Garrison wrote to Amos A. Phelps on December 16, 1835, about Channing's small book on slavery. And in this letter, he told Phelps, it makes me laugh. There is something, too, of ineffable contempt within me to see the parade which some of our would-be abolitionists are making about this little book of the great Dr. Channing on slavery. The only portions of it which are of the least consequence or value are the sheer moral plagiarisms which he has stolen for the writing of the abolitionists. The rest is a farrago of impertinence, contradiction, and defamation. Indeed, Channing was imperfect on this issue. He disagreed with slavery, but he sought a middle ground and didn't believe in abolition right away because he believed that African Americans were inferior and would need white people to care for them and watch over them, essentially. And he disagreed with the tactics of the abolitionists as being too radical. While he was never perhaps where we would want him to be on this issue, he did evolve and by the end of his life did believe in immediate abolition. William Ellery Channing died in 1842. After his death, Ezra Stiles Gannett said that the age has lost one of its brightest lights, the world one of its true benefactors. The Unitarian minister Theodore Parker, an abolitionist, said, "No man of our century who writes the English tongue has so much weight with the wise and pious men who speak it." And the Unitarian abolitionist minister Samuel May, uncle to Louisa May Alcott, said, "We look back with no little admiration upon one who, enjoying with, as he did, the highest reputation as a writer and as a divine, put at hazard the repose of the rest of his life and sacrificed hundreds of admirers of his genius, eloquence, and piety by espousing the cause of the oppressed." The people of Boston erected a statue of him which says, "He breathed into theology a new spirit and proclaimed anew the divinity of man." It's hard to imagine a Unitarian Universalism today without the influence of this singular man, William Ellery Channing. While complex and imperfect, we are richer for his legacy.